Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to our panel. I hear talking at the back. This must stop. I apologize for my lack of Italian. I can just about speak English at the moment, but thank you all for coming. We're here to talk about science fiction and the world, and why the world is bigger and better than science fiction, and the stories we should be hearing, and the voices we should be hearing. But first of all, my microphone has always been a very bad boy, because it's wearing a condom right now, and I find that slightly disturbing. Anyway, I'm Ian MacDonald, and this is the estimable...
Thank you.
Francesco Verso, come on. Anyway. It's going to be a long 45 minutes, guys. Anyway, are there any, is there anyone from the United States in the room? I saw you pointing. Anyway, if you are, please don't be offended when I say, in terms of science fiction, America must die. Because science fiction, as the language and literature of change, and the language and literature of how we wish to be, I find it kind of troubling that the voices we get tend to be from North America, and predominantly from the United States. also to a certain extent from the UK and Ireland, but it's always English speakers telling us about how the future is going to be. And I'm kind of tired of listening to those voices. I'm kind of tired of listening to particularly American social and racial problems. I'm tired of American cultural politics, and I'm tired of American politics, full stop, because it's not the world. The world is bigger. The world has its issues, and they touch in many places on USA issues, but they are not the same. And I speak as an English-speaking writer, but I think it's time that people in the English-speaking world shut up a bit and let other people talk a little bit more and be listened to. That's probably the only thing I need to say now in this entire panel. Anyway.
No. But I think you are probably one of the few voices that have tried to explore other futures, even through your language and through your books. And I will never forget the feeling I got when I read The Dervish House or Brazil or The River of Gods, just because you were trying to extrapolate some other narrative from not the usual countries. And that's not simple. I was always astonished by the level of research and the level of depth you could, you know, like you were a native writer, in a way, of course. It's worth to try, you know, and you did it wonderfully. So you said correctly, in a way, that the time has come that other cultures rise again, because science fiction wasn't born in the U.S. It was an important thing, like everything they kind of promote and commercialize, very good. But never forget, it's a European concept, and a European idea. And given this is the Eurocon, we thought it could be nice to kind of map and give the possibility of some writers, some of the best writers from Europe, to contribute to an anthology. But the concept of, let's say, non-Anglophone, and when I consider this element, non-Anglophone, including the rest of the world, I already feel bad, because we define something by a negative category, you know?
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be like that. We, in other genres, or in general in literature, the situation is not so bad, but in science fiction is really bad. I give you a couple of indexes so that you can understand how bad is the situation. Think how much time it takes for a UK-US book to be translated in 50 languages or 30 languages, and think how much time it takes for a German, Russian, French, Spanish book to be translated into one other languages, if it ever happens. And then you have already the measure of the cultural dominance of the English language and English science fiction in the world. And you can also do it in another way. Think how many books have been translated in English from all the languages of the world in the US in any given year. You will strikingly come to one number, which is 3%. This is the level of openness of the US market to the rest of the world. So if they don't care about the world, why should we do it? Why do we persist in translating just from one single language when the cost of translating from English or French or Spanish is just the same? It's basically the same. And so these are the elements that convince more and more, I hope, publishers and small presses, basically, because the big industry is not really concerned in other cultures when it's not a huge and powerful country like China, for example. So when you have a huge bestseller like The Three-Body Problem that sold 5 million copies in China, then of course somebody said, we might give it, you know, a chance. And then it, you know, it happens that Liu Cixin has been successfully translated, and his books have come and reached a wider audience. But that's not just because he was particularly appreciated. It's just because China must be understood. Know your enemy, you know, Sun Tzu used to say. So the Americans are kind of trying to say, well, let's see what happens in this Chinese science fiction. And of course, they found out a lot of other things. But it's not that they go scout for German science fiction or French science fiction or Brazilian science fiction or Russian science fiction. So I think it's up to us to create these kind of networks. And I wonder if you have had any opportunity to read any other any stories, but I can say that the level, the quality is practically the same. It's just, of course, a matter of growing as a writer. You cannot make a living in any other country just because your market is so small. How difficult it is to make it in the English market?
It's much more difficult now than it was when I started out. When I started out, maybe there were 300 or 400 books a year in science fiction. Now it's maybe 10,000 to 11,000 books in science fiction. I was lucky. I like to think I was good, but I was certainly lucky in that I hit the thing at the right time when the market was booming. I mean, as Francesco says, I mean, I've written books set in Turkey and India. I did River of God set in India because, yet again, I was reacting, I hate to say it, I was reacting against US science fiction. It's a simple question. When did you ever see anyone from India on Star Trek? Never. Because at the time when Star Trek came out, the thinking was Asia equals East Asia. It's China, Japan, Korea, to a certain extent Southeast Asia, but hey, there was a war going on there. But they had there was no concept of South Asia, of Bangladesh, of Myanmar, even of India, Nepal, Pakistan, across to Iran. There was no concept of that, and I just kind of thought, well, there's a gap in the market. The way I think of it now, it was terrific kind of cheek doing it. But I felt it kind of needed to be said, and I kind of think of myself now as John the Baptist to Christ. I am not the Christ. I point the way to the Christ, you know, hopefully. I'm just making people aware that something bigger is coming behind me that has more stuff to say and is much more relevant. At the moment, I'm looking at current project. I mean, I've been to the moon and back. At the moment, I'm looking at South Pacific, Polynesian culture, specifically the triangle of Tonga, Samoa, and Fiji in there on the South Pacific. I'm also looking north to Greenland as well, because they're places that I don't think have been looked at from a particular point of view, which is my point of view, which is always right. But it's yet again, this is my problem with post-colonial theory, is that it always comes back to being about the West. Wherever you are, you know, you're a subaltern somewhere, because it's always about the West. No, we must rid ourselves of orientating everything towards Western, largely Anglophone, but not always Anglophone intellectual culture. There are other, better, bigger ideas out there. Certainly the West has to think about its colonial history in a very big way, but not everything needs to go back to there, because it's not about what we did. That's just, you know, that's just for us. It's about, it's about people out there in the world who are in post-colonial societies. What about them? You know, it's about not always thinking it's all about the West. These people live their lives in the shadow of colonialism. They are tainted by colonialism. You know, their lives have been ruined by colonialism. Their memories are fraught with post-colonial guilt. No, these people have real lives. It's not about the West. It's about people with real lives and real stories. And let's hear them. And let's put post-colonialism into its proper box where it should be and not make it always about Western thinking, Western ideas, Western guilt, all of that, you know. It's a big world. You know, we all have voices. Let's hear them all.
But there's a tricky element there, because as a result and as a consequence of colonialism, many of these authors and many of these cultures, they want to go to the English market. Mm. They're dying, they're desperate to go into the English market. So much so that they even give up their own language and they want to write in English, because they think that the only chance they have to be heard is to write in the language of the colonizers. Mm. So given there is no translation investment, of course they're left with this very unbalanced and unfair situation where only the few, the lucky few, can afford to write in English. And I remember I was at the Utopiale in Nantes, and there was a panel on European science fiction. I was with Christopher Priest.
And I'm so sorry for you.
And the question was, oh, what can we do for European science fiction? And he said, well, you should write in English. And I said, well, and what about all the things that we express in our languages? What about our identities, our histories, our own names and culture and stuff? Do we have to give it up for you? Do we have to give it up just because we want to enter into the mainstream English literature or stuff like that? Do we, how much you pretend, and do we have to, you know, correspond to all the gatekeepers that are saying, you know, you should, you know, give me more Italian, give me more mandolino, or give me, you know, these kind of things. Like, because that's the thing, the kind of vision throughout well, of course, we are the West, but there is West and West.
There's, you know? West and West, yeah.
there are levels of Westernity, how do you call it? So it's very complicated to disengage this mechanism of, from one way, the colonization of our imagination, because if you go to any bookstore in the world, in the science fiction shelf, you will see that the number of books coming from English authors, it's really a lot compared to the native ones or the other from other languages. And there's the other side, the local authors wants to be published and write in English. So this creates a dual, you know, trap, I think, where the local markets are all overshadowed and sucked up by the English publishing industry. Yeah. Think about small markets like Finland, Sweden, the Netherlands, Belgium. I mean, they don't even have a local market. They just consider another U.S. colony or English colony or English.
Yep. And everyone reads in English anyway, because it's so widely spoken. It's a huge problem. It is a huge problem. But what's interesting about this is that it is genre leading the way on this. I imagine it's the same for local crime writers as well. It is, how can we tell our stories in our own language and be read and be noticed without being swamped by the deluge of basically Anglophone science fiction, fantasy, horror, and crime? How can we do that?
Well, the Swedish had the Swedish crime, right? They managed to do something.
Yes, they did, amazingly, and everybody copied it. We can do that. That's the whole thing. It's that the media has been so centralized in the West, particularly the mass market media and entertainment culture, However, I mean, there is a lot going on in other cultures, media-wise, you know, that we don't really know because it never gets onto our screens or into our hands.
Do you think that something like Netflix that is opening up to other cultures could be replicated on books someday?
Be lovely, but nobody reads. Sorry, nobody reads. I don't know. I think I do feel there is a solution out there somewhere, but I'm not clever enough to work out what it is or how it would work. The problem is always is about translating it not into English, but into as many languages as you need to do to get it to enough eyeballs for someone to say, this is interesting, and then make it a word of mouth hit. Publishing these days there is big publishing and then there is publishing. And at the moment, publishing is very much, they've been trying to cultivate social media for a long time, and it kind of works a bit. But the things that really work are word of mouth hits. Somebody says something, read this, puts a book in somebody's hand, and it takes off from there. But if something like, I'm going to say the G word here, 50 Shades of Grey, can take off from a very small, basically fanfic base, and become a global phenomenon, purely by word of mouth, and people saying, you know, read this, there is no reason why a book in another culture or another language from another country could not achieve that kind of critical mass and then break out and then just pass it up on to somebody else who could say, actually, this is really good, translate that, translate this. It's, for the time being, we are stuck with the thing that it's an Anglophone medium, and that's going to take a long time to turn that supertanker around. I mean, that's your 500,000 ton cruise ship with 10,000 people aboard and a casino and a Disney show every night steaming through the seas, and it takes a long time to stop that ship and all its parties and all its, and turn that ship around. And I think you have to slow it first and then turn it around. It's a difficult thing.
And if there is 1.5 billion people on the horizon?
Yes. I know, but those people on the horizon aren't there to sell trinkets and T-shirts to the cruise ship. They have their own stories and their own cruise ship as well. I'm pushing this analogy as far as I can go, guys. Somebody stop me.
Well, just to say that I will now go into a deeper element, which is the representation of the future, because. Yes, one thing is the industry, all right. But when it comes to envision the future, we're left with one culture, one economy, one religion, one single point of view, one source of ideas and concept and philosophies and attitudes and behaviors and decisions and choices, you name it. And as Ian said, the world is bigger than that, and there's now pressure to break this element, because consider the fact that for one century our imagination has been colonized by the very media that Ian told about. Hollywood, MTV, all the major global brands.
Marvel.
Marvel, you name it. It's an endless. So actually, one of my quests in the last 10 years is to really decolonize the future. And to decolonize the future, you have to, you know, scratch the layer of imagination that had been imposed one single frame at a time, one single day after the other, on our eyes, on our senses. And it's not easy, because we are being deprived of our future. And I'm not saying Italy, I'm saying most of the world. We, in Italy, for example, had brands, a whole, you know, everybody know Olivetti. We had a whole system working, but that has been, you know, completely removed. And that happened everywhere. It happened in South America, it happened in China, it happened everywhere. So probably the last 100 years, of course, even though we've seen a growth, a progress, and nobody's denying that, but when in terms of imagination, in terms of future, I mean, the fact that we landed on Mars has left basically not much.
No.
Can you imagine? We landed on Mars. And it's like normal. So there's something strange going on. I mean, we kind of adapted, we kind of felt that the future maybe doesn't belong to us anymore. Maybe it belongs to these 4 or 5 millionaires that want to go up there and colonize this. I mean, colonize what? We've already been on the moon, and they're kind of saying, oh, now we're going to the stratosphere, right? But I kind of think that the sense of wonder, the one we built the early, the very idea of science fiction, is kind of not very trendy anymore. And I switched one word, one letter, sense of wonder with A, wondering, because I think that now the future is going about countries and discover the native innovation, the things they can imagine by themselves, their own abilities to project themselves into the future, their ability to construct their own imagination without that level of colonialism, imperialism, globalization that has been imposed by the West. So if we go there, think about Peruvian futurism, Arab futurism, Indian futurism, Chinese futurism. We had one, an Italian futurism that kind of was so much encompassing all design, architecture, food, literature, art. Of course, then it went into politics and made a mess.
Yeah.
But yes. the idea was so brand new, and it touched all the possible arts and experiences of men and women, of course, but in a general, in a humankind, let's say. So I think it's a moment now that we kind of reconsider these elements.
A thing that changed me as a writer was realizing that the future arrives everywhere at the same time. There is still, particularly in Britain and Ireland, there's a sense that we are the advanced people. We get advanced technology, then we pass it down to other people. No, that doesn't happen. Everyone gets the new iPhone at exactly the same time. Everyone gets, you know, the new operating system, the new Netflix. They get all these things at the same time. One of the exciting things for me about technology in Africa is that it didn't go through the Western paradigm of here is a country, here are railways, there's some railways. Now let us put telephones everywhere, and then from telephones we can work to maybe an early internet. No, all over Africa, everyone got mobile phones at the same time, and it jumped to mobile technology straight away, and therefore everyone worked out what to do with this for themselves. And there were apps being developed that we would have no use for, which are incredibly useful in, say, rural Malawi, or for moving money around in Kenya, for which we have no use, but it's people using the technology their own way. William Gibson, bless him, said the street finds its uses for it. The street finds its own uses for things. Yes, but how very old school punk that is. The world finds its own uses for things. It's much, much bigger than that. The street is just middle-class aspiration to being a punk, I'm afraid, but the world finds its own uses for things, and it's always thrilling, and it's stuff that you'd never expect, or nobody else would ever expect, but it's people working out technology themselves. Everyone gets the same technology at the same time, so of course you're going to get people developing stories about this, or ideas, or thinking, well, what if this, what if that? Technology is flattening the planet, and I find that very exciting and very interesting. And it breaks down, yet again, it's another flaw with colonial theory, which is purely an historical theory. Everything must be rooted in the past to have any relevance to the present. And the people who are actually living in the present say, no, you know, here's what we're doing with technology. We don't care where it comes from. But it enables me to send some money back from working in Dubai to my family in Lagos or my family in Kathmandu. The world finds its own uses for things.
I remember it was last time you were here, and we had an interview, and you said this, like, yeah, William Gibson said the future is already here, but it's not evenly distributed. But actually, that's history. It's not the case anymore. Because because now, as you said, the things are distributed real time everywhere from Lagos to Rio de Janeiro.
Yeah.
So when you have this same level of technology, what makes a difference? Culture. People. People, of course, use the internet in Tokyo differently from Nigeria, because the bandwidth is completely different. So in Africa, they have to rewrite all the websites in order to make it, you know, accessible. Otherwise, you cannot open up a CNN website in Sahara with all the banners and applications and stuff and videos. So, of course, you need local solutions to global problems. And now we go into, you know, a much deeper problem. Because if you project science fiction equally into all parts of the world, you kind of blind every landscape with your science fiction. You're creating a very distorted picture of reality, because you are not allowing local solution to grow. You're not allowing local writers to grow. So there is a responsibility also for the publishers not to let this, you know, go on and on and on, so that you have impoverished the whole world, I think.
Can I just say, except it's me?
You
can buy me every time.
The thing is, I'm not saying that. Of course, I'm saying that, I have a very clear idea of it.
Yeah,
I mean, the best authors are the best authors. I'm not denying that. And Ian is one of them. But we buy the whole catalog of authors up to the last one of English and American science fiction. And in doing that, we have no place left for the best French author, best German author, for the best Indian author.
Yeah.
Let's say the Italian also.
Yeah.
So we should have a better distribution of authors. I'm just saying that. Is that so terrible?
No. I'm tired of kind of revamped European medieval fantasy and Celtic fantasy by somebody who's great, 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 great grandmother came from Ireland. Liz Burke had a great thing to say about this. It's yes, you've grown up with the stories, as have I, but the stories are different in Ireland, and Scotland and Wales, from just hearing them in the USA. It is different. It's an entirely different experience. It's not about, for me, it's not about who you are, but sense of place has always been very, very important to me. it's not who you are or who your ancestors are. It's about taking all that stuff that they know and rooting it in location and the voices of people who are there and what you see and what you smell and just everything about being somewhere. I mean, as I said, I've written about India and Brazil and Turkey and the moon, and I've been to all of them. No, I haven't. I haven't been to the moon yet. But for me, as I have to go there. Otherwise, I can't honestly write about it. Also, if I'm writing about somewhere, I need to put money back into the economy. I need to give something back to the place I'm writing about. So I feel that to be an honest writer, I have to pay back what I've got from a place I've gone to. But it's, you know, it's... writing's easy, and it's not easy at the same time. We have responsibilities, and they aren't quite the responsibilities I think that popular culture thinks they are. But we all work them out in our own way. For me, I have to be responsible to people and place. And I have to be honest about my experiences as well, and that's kind of all I can do. I don't have to respect things. I can have opinions about things, because everyone has an opinion about stuff. But for me, I have to respect people and place and be honest to my experience. That's all I can do.
We have 10 minutes. I don't know if you have any questions from the audience. Otherwise, we'll go on.
Yeah, have we any very aggrieved Americans in the room? Sorry, I apologize.
I just wanted to add a couple of things about the translation. I mean, for many years, the translators have been totally neglected, and translation has been, as usual, you know, something that was going from one language to all the others. And I think we should really try to build a network of, and again, I have to define this in a negative way, from non-Anglophone to non-Anglophone, or non-English to non-English translation. Because I think that there was a time in Europe, not so long ago, when books were going from France to Spain, from Spain to Italy, from Italy to Germany, from Russia to Poland, from, I don't know, Sweden to Portugal. Maybe not that, maybe that's very difficult. But a collaboration. I mean, what's the European about if we have just one? Of course, we are using the English language as a way to communicate. When it comes to art, culture, we don't have to, it's not necessary that we just use always the English. Of course, it's easier in our way, but think about the cultural loss. The cultural loss of not translating. I mean, I can talk just for my personal experience. I've translated from 13 languages and for 30 countries. And I found wonderful things. I mean, the Greek community of science fiction is amazing. I found out that there is a Turkish science fiction community. These people were so thankful because for the first time somebody ever translated them in another language. I translated people from Spanish. That's so easy. Translated people from Germany. It's not complicated. I translated people from Russia. There are communities everywhere. It's just that we don't get together and we don't have projects that just, you know, go beyond we don't have enough money, we don't make enough money. But the willingness to do something should be the first drive. That's my personal opinion. Then I'm doing it. So, you know, whenever if you have stories, just send them along, and I will find. I mean, it's not
he
the
said
street.
This. He said this in front of an audience, right? if you have stories,
I've published a lot of people here, so you know that they know that I can do it. Feel free to ask, but. Again, the problem of the translation is, of course, you're missing something, and it would be perfect if we could, you know, have our stories completely or immediately understandable in all languages. You know, one day it's not very far, we will have an artificial intelligence that in real time will translate that. Have you ever tried something like that?
Yeah, it's terrible. It's terrible. Can I just... I've had fabulous translators all the time. I have a great French translator, Gilles Goulet, who first of all found a plot hole in River of Gods that nobody else had found. But I was... There was a story he was translating of mine and had a line in English which went, self-facilitating media node, which is self-facilitating media node, which is a line from Charlie Brooker, from an old Charlie Brooker comedy, and it basically means wanker. And I explained the joke to him, said, if you can make that work in French, I will buy you a drink. And he went away and thought about it, and he said, I made it work in French, and he showed it to me, and it did work in French, and I bought him a drink. So these things do convey with a good translator. They can get the gist and do it. It's a very fine art indeed.
I have this metaphor that I hope it works, but I think that at the moment, the English science fiction is like a lake. You can, you know, sit on the shore of the lake, take your juicy, very good fishes. But it's a lake is a closed circle. So if you really want to go and find the big fish, the white whale, you need to go on the ocean. And to go on the ocean, you need a boat. A big boat, and that boat is a translator that knows the high sea and knows how to get that fish and take it back to you. So, of course, you can just live with your small and juicy fishes, nice ones, the lake fishes. But if you want to go and catch the white whale, like, for example, it was Liu Cixin, that was a white whale, you had to go out. You have to expose yourself. You have to risk something. Otherwise, you're left with your catalog of nice American authors. You know, that works. Yes.
There is a lot of good American science fiction,
of course, I must of say. Course. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's hamburgers. It's fast food. It's fish and chips, right?
For me, actually, the translator isn't the boat. Boat is the book. The translator is the navigator.
Okay.
They set sail. They catch the wind, and they know where how to take that book to the other shore. We're getting deeply into analogy.
You have Ian McDonald working on your metaphor, that's
sorry. Hello, metaphor engineering specialist. In the words of the Waterboys, that was the river. This is the sea.
Excellent. You're right. Yeah. Okay. I mean, if I don't know if you have anything else to add, but...
I just say this is the first room I've been in where it's got busier as it's gone on. Thank you.
The thing is, you can find these books that are an effort to map and list and gather together the voices of European science fiction for the Eurocon in English. Yes, in English. But at least you can understand who are the people doing their own things in their local language.
Yeah.
I made the effort to translate a short story. It is possible. And if you're curious to know who are these people from 15 countries in Europe? I couldn't map everything. There are some parts that are missing, but it's number one, so there is hope there will be a number two. And I'm doing the same for world science fiction, again, because consider the fact that every time you see the best of this and the best of that is a selection made by an English or American editor that is probably haven't translated but has selected the stories based on what arrived on his desk already written in English. So it's a good selection, but it's an easy selection. Okay, thank you.
Avete ascoltato Fantascientificast, podcast di fantascienza e cronache della galassia, da un'idea di Paolo Bianchi e Omar Serafidi, con il contributo cibernetico del Cylon Prof Massimo De Santo. Potete seguirci ed interagire con noi sul nostro sito fantascientificast.it, su Facebook alla pagina Fantascientificast, su Twitter sul profilo @fantascicast, sul nostro canale Telegram t.me/fantascientificast, sulla nostra community Telegram t.me/fsccommunity. Se siete particolarmente timidi, potete utilizzare la vecchia, cara e affidabile posta elettronica scrivendoci all'indirizzo redazione@fantascientificast.it. Tutte le puntate sono disponibili sul nostro sito, su Apple iTunes, su Spotify e su Podbean all'indirizzo podcast.fantascientificast.it. Se volete, potete lasciarci una valutazione a 5 stelle su Apple iTunes ed offrirci una birra romulana o un gotto esplosivo pangalattico, sostenendoci tramite una donazione PayPal utilizzando l'apposito pulsante sul nostro sito. Fantascientificast è una produzione amatoriale. Non si intende infrangere alcun copyright, i cui diritti appartengono ai rispettivi detentori. L'autorizzazione SIAE 5612I5359. Nessun byte e nessun tribolo sono stati maltrattati durante la produzione di questo podcast. Alexa 4 e l'equipaggio di Fantascientificast vi augurano lunga vita e prosperità e vi danno appuntamento alla prossima puntata lungo la rotta di Kessel.
Settimo simbolo inserito nel computer. Blocco 1 pronto. Blocco 1 posizionato.
Potenza erogata 23%. Così.
Blocco 2 è pronto.
Attivato.
Blocco 2 posizionato.
Siamo al 35%.
Arme rosse, evacuare l'area intorno allo Stargate.
Liberate l'area, torniamo da voi, chiudo le porta.
Andiamo, sbrigate.
C'era quello sotto la grande pietra?
Sì. Mio padre lo trovò nel 1928. È fatto di un minerale che non si trova sulla Terra.
Blocco 5 posizionato.
85%.
Blocco 6 pronto. Blocco 6 posizionato.
Non eravamo mai riusciti ad andare oltre nella sequenza.
Blocco 7 pronto.
Pronto, attivato.
Blocco 7 posizionato.
Thank you.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Waiting on a tax return? Hopefully it ends up in your hands. Fraudulent tax returns due to identity theft increased by 30% in 2023. If you're in a bind this tax season, LifeLock can help. Our U.S.-based restoration specialists are experts dedicated to helping solve your identity theft issues. And all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. So we'll reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. Help protect your information this tax season with LifeLock. Save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/aware.